This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And we stream at the same time we broadcast at prairiepublic.org. And today we're starting with a very interesting fellow with an interesting story, I think, to tell about a film he's making. Dirk Wieringa is the filmmaker in question, and he is traveling a 1,500-mile route from the North Shore of Michigan to Shelby, Montana. And for what purpose, Dirk?
Well, it's really quite an interesting story because it's really about a 1,500-mile stretch, which is the center portion of US 2, and it's all about booms and busts. So, and basically, so it goes everywhere from the fur trapping to the iron ore, to the lumber, to the copper mining, and now to the oil here. Plus, there's, of course, agriculture with ranching and farming, which is its own boom and bust.
Well, you're from Grand Haven, Michigan. You're well south of Highway 2 in your state. So what drew you to that particular piece of road?
Well, a couple things. One is that I've traveled it very many times in my career, so I'm very well familiar with it. But more important probably is that I have a passion for rural America, and the challenge is that most people in urban areas, which is the vast majority of people, do not know what rural is because they might live in, let's say, Washington, D.C., and they might go 20 miles into Maryland, find some rural areas and think it's rural. But those people are going to Johns Hopkins for their medical care.
And the film you're working on is Route to Elsewhere. What's the significance of the title?
Well, Elsewhere, well, Route 2 obviously is US 2.
Yes.
But Elsewhere is actually, I'm a big fan of the author of Blue Highways, William Least Heat Moon.
Yes.
And he very often uses the word elsewhere. And so it's kind of in honor of him.
That's a great book, and I have used it to inspire some car trips of my own. You know, the roads less traveled and for, you know, sort of self-discovery. It's an interesting book to read.
Absolutely.
Now, U.S. Highway 2 has an eastern route and a western route, and you're focused on the western piece, and not all of it, because it ends in Everett, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's correct.
Again, why this particular stretch?
Well, once you get past into the foothills of the mountains and start going through the mountains, it stops being the same kind of a road. It becomes more of a touristy, more of a large city of Spokane. You have the Everett, which is a part of basically of Seattle.
So yeah.
They just don't fit in with what Route 2 really is. When I
Googled it, Dirk, I discovered U.S. Highway 2 has an interesting Wikipedia page, mm-hmm. and it follows the old Theodore Roosevelt Highway that was intended back in, you know, about 100 years ago, mm-hmm. to connect Portland, Maine with Portland, Oregon.
yep, absolutely. And it cut through Canada on what became Canada 17. But when the U.S. highway system came up with the U.S. Designation, of course, the Canadians didn't want to be part of that.
Now, when did you start this project, and when do you think you'll be done with it?
Well, the starting of it really came conceptually about just over a year ago when I started first initially making travel, and I decided that I was going to embed myself starting in September through this coming June, basically because it's very important to also cover weather. And so that ensures me all four seasons. Plus the fact is I didn't want to travel the summertime because a lot of people along this route, that's the only time they make their money. And I don't want to be an interference.
Well, you're going to experience winter. I think we've got a nice taste of it coming.
Oh yeah, I spent 3 days in Grand Forks here during that last big storm about a month ago.
So you're back in Grand Forks. How often do you make the 1,500-mile drive?
I try to make it both directions. Obviously, start on one end, and then you have to go back to this where you started. So each time I make the route, it's usually 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay. And what do you do when you stop someplace? How do you decide where to stop and who to talk to?
Well, the initial work that I did way back a year ago identified a lot of key players. So I began to talk with those people, knowing that I would be coming and starting filming in September. And so I used them in order to find other people. And then as the social engagement step started coming, people are getting pretty active on my Facebook page. And so I'll give you an example. Hopefully you won't mind me using his name. I wrote a little piece about Willow City because they have a school that closed there, and it just really devastated the town, especially in spirit. And so I wrote a little piece about it. And John Erdman, who owns a farm there, who's also a truck driver, he contacted me and he says, I live there. I said, can I come and interview you? He said, fine. So, and he's been just a marvelous person to be talking to because he's got a good sense of both why two jobs are important and really why, and he understands the trucking part of it and he understands family farming. And he really wished that he could just stay doing family farming. But he said, once it gets into your into your life, you never want to lose it.
Well, Route 2 is a very important route for trucks through North Dakota. I know that very well. And Dirk, you have been on this route more than once now, and you established some relationships, if you will, with people. So how do you intend to tell the story?
Well, first of all, I've still got 5 more months of taping, so I'm halfway through. But each time that I meet other people, they lead me to other people. A lot of times I start with economic development because that's pretty prevalent. A lot of times I'll use chambers of commerce. But they get me kind of to the next level of person. And then once I'm with that level, I really want to stay with that particular story. So the main stories, an example would be, I've got Blue Weber here in downtown Grand Forks. He's one of the people that's in it. John Erdman, like I mentioned. Leela Peterson, who's an author of the book Selma, which is all about homesteading. I have Jesse Veeder, who's a rancher, singer-songwriter.
We know her, yeah.
Yep, she's wonderful, incredible writer. And singer. And her father, who used to be head of economic development there, Gene.
Yes. And
also Merrick and Julia Petrovic over at Farmtastic Food down in Anamoose. So I try to have 4 to 6 stories per state that become kind of the method by which to tell the story.
You're talking about boom and bust towns, and Highway 2 was created before the interstate highway system, which bypassed a lot of towns, for example, a lot of towns on Highway 2. And so talk a bit about how the times and have affected people in a boom and bust way. We all know about the oil patch in North Dakota, but there are towns in the middle of Highway 2 in North Dakota that next to each other, one's successful, the other is less successful.
And you know, so much of that was really James J. Hill in the planning of the Great Northern, because, you know, US 2 really follows that route.
And US 10 follows the other one. The other
I know, and which he bought later on. Yeah. So it's a wonderful story because of the fact that each of those boom and busts, and agriculture is a very big part of the story, of course, in North Dakota. And part of what really drives the loss of population in those towns is actually the efficiency of modern day ranching and farming, is that you need a larger ranch or farm and you need fewer people there. Well, if you have a town that used to have let's say 500 people and it had a hardware store and a grocery store and a gas station and so forth, all of a sudden now you have a fraction of that population that's ever coming into that town. So it starts to close businesses and it just kind of builds on itself.
Dirk Wieringa is a filmmaker. He's working on a documentary, Route 2 Elsewhere. He's traveling on U.S. Highway 2 from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan to Shelby, Montana. How has this project informed you about the challenges, though, some towns and people face? Because, again, you've got small town A doing well, you know, 10, 15 miles down the road, small town B, failing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there can be a number of reasons for that. A lot of times it can come right down to the leadership within a community where if you have, you oftentimes hear a city person, somebody in a city talking about when the council flipped. And by that, what they mean is that they kind of went from the old guard to a newer guard. And the old guard, really, they were all about the backbreaking type work. You know, they moved dirt, they built things. That's the type of and so they see that as being jobs. But now the newer people, they see it more like, how can I live where I want to live? So in other words, how can I stay in North Dakota, which is a big part of this, and also still have a successful career? Well, you can if you have business grade internet. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that people think that they may have it because they can get a Netflix film. but the reality is that business grade internet is all about how much you can push and create and push out onto the internet. And most people don't have that. In fact, but there are some really wonderful examples out there of towns that are growing quickly. One's in Minnesota, not too far from here, is Bemidji. And they have the high-speed internet available to everybody there because they have a nonprofit that was able to really underwrite a lot of the funding of it. And
yeah, they also have a university and a community college system up there, mm-hmm. too. So young people are there, and I think mm-hmm. that's part of the issue that you may have been confronting as you go along Highway 2. Some of these towns don't have any young people in them.
That's exactly right. I call it the missing generation, which are people 24 to 49. They're the people that typically are going to have families, and if they're not around, you're losing population. And a lot of times, it really comes down to looking up the people who left that did not want to leave, because most people don't want to leave. They leave because they have to leave. And if the same type of an opportunity can be had around in the town that they want to come back to, that's possible. And again, if they're able to work off-site and live in an area where they like, and of course we know the off-site work is becoming a huge part of our economy.
Dirk Wieringa has a Facebook presence, as he mentioned, and his last name, and he told me it's Dutch, is spelled W-I-E-R-E-N-G-A. And Dirk, I saw a posting you had from February 9th. I just want to share it with our listeners. If America is going to become a greater country, we need to stop judging and start listening.
Yes, that's very important. And at the time, I was just leaving Watford City, and I was actually looking at a guy unloading his trailer. He was moving there from Texas. And what people don't realize is, in Watford City, as an example, is a very diverse economy. It has people from all 50 states, 20-some foreign countries, and they have actively been diversifying their economy. So even though they have income from the oil, they're using that in order to build a much bigger economy because they don't want to go through the same kind of boom and bust that other towns have gone through.
And they've gone through it because there was a boom in the 50s, there was a boom in the 80s, and mm-hmm. and now there's a boom in the 21st century.
Yep.
And I think they've perhaps learned a couple of lessons.
I think the whole state's learning good lessons about this.
Well, Watford City was an interesting example because when the boom hit it, of course, all of these oil workers were coming into town, and some of them, frankly, didn't last long. They moved mm-hmm. back because the weather can be intimidating, and the jobs became, you know, the extraction business became more efficient, and they didn't need as many people. Mm-hmm. But that influx created a need for restaurants and laundromats and mm-hmm. other services that towns that are growing require. And so now those services remain, I take it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the growth that they're seeing, because an awful lot of the oil jobs are temporary jobs. They come in, they do their job, they're not going to buy and build or buy a house. And so it's the people that are investing in the community, and those are local people.
How do you cover the expenses for the time and travel to make this documentary?
Well, so far, my partner, Vern Jones, and his wife, Irene, and myself, we're partners in Principia Media. And we're just kind of self-funding it at this point, waiting to see what happens. What we would love to get it on PBS. PBS, though, really wants to see something fully developed first. And so that's a part of why we're doing it the way we're doing it. But we're very committed to this project. It's going to go out somewhere, someplace, and in a broadcast manner.
Well, I noted on your IMDb page, that's the internet directory for movies and filmmakers and people like you, that you started a marketing communications agency back in the 1980s, and mm-hmm. you made your first real documentary film was a full-length episodic documentary for television, D.B. Cooper, The Real Story. That was back mm-hmm. in 2018.
Yep.
So if PBS doesn't bite, is this a reality TV project?
I don't know if it's a reality TV. I would say that it would be more of a standard story based type of film, but we're really kind of waiting because, as I said, I've got five more months of being out here, and so you really don't know. I can tell you, I have a lot of footage,
and you all by yourself. You're the filmmaker, you're the editor, and you're asking the questions. So that's a pretty intimate interview style, and probably gets some real candor out of people.
Well, people really don't really want to talk to people. I've had a lot of people that I've interviewed that had also been interviewed or known of people that were interviewed by major media from, you know, one of the coasts. And those people would have a tendency to bomb in and bomb out and do a quick interview in a coffee house and they're on their way. And so, and then when they see the story later on, it doesn't have anything to do with the truth that they felt. So people are very skeptical of that. So it's very important for me to get into their lives a lot more and to learn from them. I am learning so much. I learn incredible amount every day, but it's from the people that I talk with.
So your style would be to sit down and probably talk for quite a while. You probably want to at least do some editing on paper.
Well, actually, we're not even going to start the post-production until probably early July, and that'll probably take 6 months or more.
Well, I'm just thinking, Al said this about a half an hour into our chat, because you know, 5 months from now, you're going to have hundreds of hours of video?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, it gives us a lot of choices.
Yes. Yeah, you might go blind doing it.
Well, somebody, in fact, I was talking to Chuck Wilder, who he owns Books on Broadway in Williston, and he was saying, he said, you're the new Charles Kuralt.
And I said, on the road with Charles Kuralt. Yes.
Yeah. And I said, well, actually, there's so much stuff that it could be episodic.
Well, Charles Kuralt actually came through Fargo a long, long time ago when he was doing the On the Road pieces. And he was a very approachable guy. And I think that mm-hmm. probably helps if you want to talk to people about real life and their real struggles.
Well, people are really looking for authenticity right now, and I don't think they're getting it so much from political figures. And as a result, I think as a country, we've kind of gotten our differences are defining us more than what we share in values. And actually, what I'm learning from this story is really how shared those values are. We are an incredible country. We just need to realize that.
Well, you mentioned Blue Weber. He's the executive director of the Downtown Development Association in Grand Forks, and you were talking to the Greater Grand Forks Young Professional Association mm-hmm. when you were interviewed for the Forum News Service
yes.
back in the middle of December.
Wonderful organization.
So the idea that I'm getting here is that you might come up with some, you know, proposals for towns that might help them boost themselves.
I could see that happening. And of course, we're also a book publisher, so we are always looking for books. And there's a lot of people that are into writing historical books. So we've kind of talked to some people about that too. But if you really believe in something and if you throw yourself into it, eventually something good comes from it, no matter what. And if this doesn't turn into what I envisioned it to be, it's going to turn into something that is the proper.
Dirk Wieringa is a filmmaker. His work in progress is Route to Elsewhere. He joined us from our microphone in Grand Forks. Good fortune to you, Dirk.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure being here.
Support for Brave Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing Tanya Tucker and the CMT Next Women of Country. Bring My Flowers Now Tour with Brandi Clark to the Fargo Theater on Friday, February 28th.
Bring my flowers now. While I'm living.
Tickets are on sale now at jadepresents.com or by calling 866-380-300.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Jim Puppy was in his late 50s when he started a daunting project that's emphasized in the title of the book that resulted, Dakota Attitude, interviews from every town in North Dakota. Last week he sat down in our studio to talk about why and how he did it. We started with his story.
Well, I was raised about 6 miles from a small town called Hensel. It is in Pembina County, just an extreme eastern part of North Dakota, and went to country school. There were two in my first grade, and also went to a country church, which was nearby. Upon graduation from Cavalier High School, I attended the North Dakota State School of Forestry, and also from there I went to the University of North Dakota, graduated. Was drafted into the to the Army and spent 2 years in service, 1967 and 1969, part of which I spent in Vietnam. From there, I came back and worked for the Veterans Administration. I rated disability. But the life-changing experience I had at the Veterans Administration was working with the former prisoners of war.
Oh.
And I was their advocate. At one time, there's probably a high of 150 former prisoners of war that I worked with and then helped with their benefits.
Most of these would have been Vietnam veterans? Or
most of these would be World War II veterans.
Oh, from older veterans.
Older veterans, yeah. The ones from the European theater and the former Japanese prisoners of war.
Well, and then you became an advocate for veterans and retired from that job?
Exactly right. And I heard that one time years ago that we know more about the soil of North Dakota than what we know about the people. And so there was something that was in my mind, or the idea that, we need to, or at least I wanted to find out what the people of North Dakota were all about. So I started out and with the idea that I was going to visit somebody from every town in North Dakota. So opened up the North Dakota map and went from there.
And even in a small state like North Dakota, there are lots of towns, over 600 of them, huh?
Well, actually about 400 and some towns that's on the map. My basis was the North Dakota road map. So if the town was on a map, I was there.
Well, some of those towns that are on the map aren't really there anymore.
You're exactly right. There's a couple of the villages that are listed where there's no population. So I had to chase somebody down that used to live there.
Now, had you written other things when you set about writing this book?
Well, I did some family histories, my grandparents, both my mother's and my father's side. But this was kind of a new venture for me.
And this venture took 11 years of your life, a fair amount of time.
Yeah, it did. It took quite a while. Well, most of the work was done during the summer months when I would travel in my van and I had a sleeping bag in there, eat peanut butter sandwiches and Jolly sandwiches And it was fun.
Well, you must have sampled some cafe fare along the way.
Well, not too much, but the people I interviewed, most of the interviews took place on at the kitchen table. And good coffee and good homemade bread, donuts and cookies and homemade soups. Oh, they were just so cordial.
Well, you started in 2004, mm-hmm. and you put a lot of miles on your Dodge van.
Mm-hmm.
How many?
Well, we totaled it up 113,000 miles in my travels throughout throughout the state.
What was your process when you'd go into a town? I suppose you had to explain what you were doing there and maybe get some direction about who you might want to talk to.
Well, the first thing I did is I told them I was a native North Dakota myself. I'm no farm boy, and that seemed to help. I'd stop in at a cafe or see somebody on the street or you know, any place where there's somebody. And sometimes you had to look pretty hard because there wasn't much activity in some of these smaller towns. And then I would find out who in that town was somebody of good human spirit, somebody that had optimism, good moral values, and integrity. And so they would refer me to this person. And, you know, Doug, they were right.
Yeah.
I got some beautiful people and some people of real deep wisdom, and that's what I was after.
And I read in a story that Patrick Springer wrote for Forum News Service that you typically look for older residents of the town because they might have for some historical perspective about the place.
Well, that's it. And it also, an older person has a more chance to experience things in life.
Sure.
So they have a longer period of time to reflect. And that's what I was after. When I visit with these people, I find out about their younger lives and what information or what experiences they had to make them what they are at that time.
So you're recording these interviews?
They are all recorded. Each interview probably averaged about 45 minutes apiece. And I had them sign a release of information so I could use it for publication. And also a photograph of each person that's shown in the book. So there's 617 stories and 617 photographs.
And it's organized by county. So it starts with Adams County. And
that's correct.
Goes right through Williams County.
Exactly.
And in the counties, it's organized. The towns are organized alphabetically as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What when you set out, Jim, were you planning to write a book or were you just planning to gather some histories or –
What I really wanted to do is that I don't know what it is, but I think God gave me the ability to sit down and visit with somebody and extract information, little virtues of their life that could be shared with others, and take this, and I wanted to place it into a book so I can share it with others.
Well, the book is titled Dakota Attitude. Jim Puppy is the author. And as I understand in some of the introductory material in the book, that your late daughter-in-law, Sarah, suggested the title.
Right. Sarah passed away about 3 years ago. She died of a brain tumor, and she was literary in many different areas and had interest in writing herself, but unfortunately her life was taken and she didn't have the opportunity to complete it.
As you mentioned, you used a highway map to chart your course across the state. What was the smallest place you tried to gather information in? And you mentioned some of these towns weren't there, and that meant you had to go someplace else to find somebody who'd lived there.
Right. Well, I think Fillmore, North Dakota, I think is one person that comes to my mind.
Huh.
And he lived there for a number of years, and I asked him about future plans. Well, they're going to have to carry him out feet first, he says. So that was probably very indicative amongst people that there's an old German saying, home is where you were rocked in a cradle, and I think this surfaced when I was out there. People love to be where they were at, and that was home. They're very familiar with it, and they knew everything about the town. If you didn't know, you just ask them.
Well, Sarah, your daughter-in-law, that title, Dakota Attitude, mm-hmm. What does that suggest to you when you put out a book that says Dakota Attitude? What's Dakota Attitude?
Well, I think it's special virtues that people have in North Dakota, the honesty, the integrity, and also untapped resources out there that we could really learn from. And I think that the attitude of North Dakota is something that we can really be proud of because we're special people.
Let's listen to a sample of one of the interviews you conducted. This is with Lydia Rorick. She's in Strasburg, North Dakota. For people who have the book, she's on page 189. And her story starts in your telling of it. She was married in 1948. They first lived with her parents for a couple of days. Then they moved in with his folks. Let's listen to her.
And then you lived with his folks?
Till in fall, they moved to town, and then we were on the farm.
Okay. So did you have was there another bedroom in the house? Or?
Well, upstairs. Yeah. And I bet you it was 100 hot every night.
But you were still happy?
Oh.
Didn't make any difference?
Didn't make any difference. No fan, no electricity, nothing. We didn't have no money. The boys were going to take us along to the movie, and my husband said, no.
What boys?
We don't have money. It's a neighbor to my husband.
Okay.
And didn't have money.
You didn't have money to go to a movie in Strasburg.
So we stayed home, but we didn't care.
Well, I slept in the upstairs of a two-story house.
Yeah.
And in August, it gets hot.
Oh.
But no problem. You were happy, huh?
So happy.
So would you be with them during the day out in the field then? Or?
No, I was home with his mother and the dad. You know, they did back. And I told that to the girls that first summer. And I don't like to iron, but I just love to iron his shirts. Isn't that so silly?
That's Lydia Rorick from Jim Puppy's book, Dakota Attitude, interviews from every town in North Dakota. Of course, we mentioned, Jim, that she's from Strasburg, North Dakota, one of the favorite sons of North Dakota, came from there. That's Lawrence Welk, and it turns out that was her uncle.
That's correct.
That's a small town. Mm-hmm. Your storytelling here is interesting because you spent all this time interviewing these people. You've got what is, I think, a wealth of information for an archive of some sort. But you had to take that interview and boil it down, distill it down to like a 350-word, one-page essay. That takes a lot of work.
It's difficult to do for an untrained literary person as me. But I had help from Chandice Johnson, who formerly taught at NDSU. He was very helpful and we tried to keep the voice of the person. We didn't want to lose that. So he was very helpful and make sure that what the vet – I go back to my former employment, a veteran. But, I mean, as the interview spoke, we wanted to capture that and maintain that throughout. And also I had editor Victoria, which was, you know, whom was very, very good at it. And we were able to get it down to about 300 to 350 words per page. So.
Wow. Well, you went home. You went up to Pembina County, went back to Hensel, didn't you?
I sure did.
And so who did you pick there?
Well, I didn't pick a neighbor or a relative. I picked somebody from the other side of town, one of the Icelanders up in that area.
No shortage of them.
Yeah. And he was referred to me as just a very hard worker all his life and raised a number of children and just in a small acreage and milked cows. He was in dairy business for an entire life, spent time in war during World War II and very, very admired by others.
How much time would you spend in a town, not necessarily Hensel, but, you know, like Strasburg?
Well, on the average, I'd say about an hour and a half. I would drive in kind of cold turkey and then look around what was happening there in town and whom I could visit with and kind of start up a conversation with somebody. I wouldn't tell them I was from out east or anything. I was one of you people.
Well, you must have had quite a spiel because that's pretty efficient, going into a town an hour and a half later, heading down the road to the next one.
Well, it worked. And initially, you know, when I knocked on somebody's door that whom was referred to me, maybe the door just opened a few inches, but then after we stood there and talked for just a short period of time, then they were willing to sit down and visit with me.
Well, some of these stories must have been absolutely fascinating too. Again, I'll refer to Patrick Springer's piece in the Forum News Service back in earlier in January. He talked about you interviewing Pauline Rohl of Heil in Grant County, a mother who had 21 children in 21 years. Mm-hmm. Wow.
What a beautiful lady she was. She was in her mid-80s and 21 kids. 21 years. By the way, there are two sets of twins in there, so that helped out with the numbers.
Well, that's a heck of a big family, though. All of those all those kids, the grandkids, great-grandkids, that must be a heck of a reunion.
Yeah, it certainly would be. Yeah. And she just so such a pleasant person. It seemed like she would take things by the smooth handle and well adjusted.
Now, this is 16 years ago. You started on this mission to, mm-hmm. that ended up with the book Dakota Attitude, Interviews from Every Town in North Dakota. There must be lots of people you talked to, since you were talking to older residents of the town, who are no longer with us.
I would say between 30 and 35% of the people whom I've interviewed have passed.
Mm-hmm. So this becomes a treasure to the members of their family, I suspect.
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, let's talk about putting out a book that could be a doorstop. This is a heavy, big book. It's over 600 pages. Each page tells one story. And, of course, there's an index to it as well. How did you get to the point of producing a book? It's not a cheap prospect.
Well, I worked with Fargo Printing, and they were very helpful over there and understanding, and they knew that they were working with an amateur, somebody with no experience with this. And
this is Forum Publications?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And we didn't know if we should put the book in four separate books or two. And I decided that why not try and put it all into one book? Easier for sales and more distribution. But we had to sharpen ourselves in trying to get the right story for each one for each person of 300 to 350 words a piece. So,
well, the book sells for about $30. It's a very substantial book, as I mentioned. It's got a lot of photographs in it. So this book, which sells for $30, how many have you sold? How many copies?
Well, we just we're thinking about a third printing at this time.
Wow.
But we sold over 4,000 copies already.
Yeah. Well, it probably helps to interview a lot of people because I suspect Mom and Dad and the kids would like to have a copy of the book.
Well, I imagine for marketing that would be.
You weren't thinking about that, huh?
Well,
just got lucky?
Yeah. Well, some were not so lucky in that respect either. Some didn't have children. Talking about the size of the book, Dr. Bonnemeyer, a retired dentist in Fargo, he's featured in the book. He's a former prisoner of war. He called me up and he said, Jim, he said, I have a complaint. And I said, oh, really? Yeah, I complained about the book. And I didn't know what it was. I started to get a little nervous and I didn't know what he was going to tell me. And I said, well, what's the complaint? He says, the book is too heavy, he said. He says, for a 95-year-old man to be laying in bed and holding up this book, he says, it's too heavy.
Well, maybe there's an audio version coming out for a very long car trip.
Okay.
Jim Puppy is the author of Dakota Attitude, Interviews from Every Town in North Dakota. It's really a fascinating read. So thank you, Jim, for stopping by Main Street.
Well, thank you, Doug.
Especially after going to so many.
On this week's Prairie Public Presents, we bring you two programs in honor of Black History Month. First, it's Songs of the People, indigenous roots of black folk music, which traces its connections to the traditional music of the First Nations of America.
Black and Native people are uniquely positioned to understand each other. One, a people of stolen lands, and the other, a stolen people.
Then on Artworks, we dive deep into Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration, which brought vibrant African-American culture to the entire country.
Toni Morrison's parents migrated from Alabama to Ohio. She would have had the opportunity to go to integrated schools and just walk into a library and take out a book.
Songs of the People and Artworks, coming up this afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we have another offering from Poetry from Studio 47. It's hosted by Patrick Hicks, writer in residence and a member of the English faculty at Augustana College in Sioux Falls. Here's his profile of poet Leanne Rorapaw.
Rorapaw was born in Laramie, Wyoming on October 21, 1965. Her mother immigrated from Japan and married her father, the poet Robert Rorapaw. As the child of an immigrant and as a second-generation Japanese-American, Rorapaw came to understand intersectional identities and what it means to come from two different cultures at an early age. She received her bachelor's in music from Indiana University in 1987, a master in music from the same institution 2 years later, and an MFA in poetry shortly after that. To read her work is to realize her care in how words sound. There is music to her work, the syllables, the beats, the rhythm, the pacing. She has written a number of collections, including Beyond Heart Mountain, Year of the Snake, On the Cusp of a Dangerous Year, Dandarians, and her latest collection, Tsunami versus the Fukushima 50. In this, she writes about the tsunami that happened in March 2011 that devastated the nuclear power plant in Fukushima, and how those who tried to stabilize the meltdown sacrificed their lives. Rorapaw has won the Academy of American Poets Prize, the Randall Jarrell International Poetry Prize, the Association of Asian American Studies Book Award, and she has won fellowships from the Bush Foundation, the South Dakota Arts Council, and many others. From 2015 until 2019, she was the Poet Laureate of South Dakota. She is currently a professor of English at the University of South Dakota, where she is also editor of South Dakota Review. Today's poem is Octopus in the Freezer. The title of this poem sets the stage, and it tells us what it's about. Here, Rorapaw remembers a frozen octopus in her childhood freezer. It's a 3-page poem that opens with a series of extended questions. In fact, questions make up at least 2/3 of this poem. It's about culture and how culture is transplanted elsewhere. I like how this poem ends with a raw sense of yearning. This is Octopus in the Freezer by Leanne Rorapaw. What could you possibly have been dreaming of as you slumbered coiled there, tentacles furled about your large soft brow, bashful and pink, ruminating in the back corner beneath an arched shelf of antelope ribs, snugged between headless bodied broods of sage grouse and ice-bright pillows of sure-fine lima beans and the buttered currency of carrot medallions? What were you thinking down there in my parents' basement, blue blood's pulse stilled to a wiry tangle of navy ribbon, the syncopated bongo drum thump and thrum of your three hearts on break between sets and resting silent on the stage? By what unlikelihood were you frozen solid in this tight-wound pose, like a multi-limbed Hindu goddess in lotus position, riding the plains by freight truck to Shakura Square in Denver, where my mother admired the brawny circumference of your arms, the snow-white firmness of your inner flesh, the rubbery erect grip of your suction cups? And what were the odds that you'd be packed in dry ice by the Oji-san behind the counter, tucked into our avocado-green igloo ice cooler and driven home across the state line to Wyoming? You remain frozen in time in my parents' freezer, totemic, statuesque, infinite, and apocryphal, even though you've been eaten many times over, one arm at a time, sliced thin into cross-section slivers for sushi on birthdays and holidays. As a child, I used to think the dull, muffled thud and clunk of the furnace firing into life at night was the sound of your head bumping up against the freezer lid, the cold grate and clash of meat shifting, scraping against one another in the wake of your thrashing tentacles' lash and whip. What error in judgment took you from your cozy niche, your eclectic garden arranged with such compulsive precision? The slender-necked and lush-hipped wine bottles, the shiny, winking bits of mirror startling back your placid, mild eye, the pickle jar whose lid you love to screw and unscrew, dangling in a tapered arm, your exquisitely sensitive, ganglia-rimmed suckers quivering to check for tasty things to eat. Did you become snarled in a fisherman's net or clasped tight in the steel embrace of a lobster trap, caught in the careless kleptomania of your endless lust for crustacea? And did your chromatophores pulse first white, then red, to semaphore the blushing flush of fear flaming to anger? Were you caped in a swirl of spewed blackness, dispensing the way sumi ink curls away from the tornado whirl of a horsehair brush being twirled clean in water? Today the snow just falls and falls, and I think of you as the relentless volatile wind lifts the flakes into blinding, shimmering white veils that spiral and mist. So cold the fine spray delicately burns for one moment against the skin, and frozen feathery etchings are flung up against the windows like splayed bits of goose down. Cars and trucks cough and come to a halt. My back door freezes shut. The barometer drops, and empty wine bottles line the kitchen counter like bowling pins. How odd, I keep thinking to myself, as everything around me creaks and groans and shivers, then stills to ice and frost. How odd that it has all come to this. And then I wish for someone, anyone at all, to dream of me, if only for a moment, to unfurl my rigid, aching limbs and melt down all my hearts, taste my salt on their tongue, let ice transubstantiate to breathing flesh, and resurrect me back into the living again.
That was Patrick Hicks reading Octopus in the Freezer from poet Leanne Rorapaw. Poetry from Studio 47 is recorded at Augustana University and is produced by Peter Folliard.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it with you.
Dallas.
Des Moines.
Topeka.
Montana.
Cleveland.
San Francisco.
Denver.
Philadelphia.
Minneapolis.
Miami.
Colorado.
Washington.
You will own your morning, wherever you are, when you choose to spend tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Beginning at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezrin is a professor of history and a storyteller. His Plainsfolk essays bring history to life, and today's is no exception. Consider the term lightning rod. It can mean a device to safely channel the dangerous energy of a lightning bolt, or a person who makes things happen. Here's his essay titled, The Lightning Rod Man.
In April 1909, the Jamestown Alert issued the following public service announcement. George E. Bates of Grand Forks, a lightning rod man, registered at the Capitol Hotel today. This notice may seem innocuous, but it was intended as a warning and also a jest. Nowadays, it requires some explanation. In 1909, everyone knew what the joke was. Come spring, traveling salesmen would show up at the farm gate again, and the most notorious among them was the lightning rod man. Indeed, the very phrase, lightning rod man, was a joke unto itself, guaranteed to provoke guffaws, if not profanity. Serious readers might have been familiar with a story, The Lightning Rod Man, published by Herman Melville in 1856. Melville's storied salesman shows up during a thunderstorm, a lean, gloomy figure, hair dark and lank, his sunken pitfalls of eyes were ringed by indigo halos and played with an innocuous sort of lightning, the gleam without the bolt. The sales pitch goes badly, and the master of the house snatches the salesman's rod away, the narrator recounting, "I seized it, I snapped it, I dashed it, I trod it, and dragging the dark lightning king out of my door, flung his elbowed copper scepter after him. But spite of my treatment, the lightning rod man still dwells in the land and drives a brave trade with the fears of man." Prairie folk with less literary tastes read popular fiction featuring Lightning Rod men in their weekly papers. Many stories appeared under the name M. Quad, which was the pseudonym of Charles Bertrand Lewis. A graduate of Michigan Agricultural College and a veteran of the 6th Michigan Volunteer Cavalry, Lewis churned out stories for newspaper syndication, many of them touching on farm life to appeal to country readers. I have located 4 stories by Lewis in which a lightning rod man figures prominently. I think Lewis himself must have worked his way through college selling lightning rods because his lightning rod men are perceptive chaps. In one story, the lightning rod man gets taken to court and has to pay damages for running over a hog. He returns to the community, however, with a new scheme that involves getting all the men drunk. He ignites a fight among them and then sits sipping in a nearby tavern while everyone else gets blacked and bruised. Another story describes a community in panic over a lad who keeps having dreams of dire events, the sheriff getting beat up, livestock being killed by lightning, that sort of thing, which always come true. Men are discussing violent action against the boy and his family when a lightning rod man arrives, assesses the situation, and dispenses some gentle advice, which is taken. Just pay the offending family to move west and be done with them. The best story of the lot has an O. Henry flair to it. The lightning rod man fails to make a sale to a widow woman, but returns a month later just to talk. He informs her there is a gentleman in a nearby community who needs a good wife, but he is deaf and dumb. Unknown to the widow, the salesman has told the gentleman that he should call upon the widow, but be apprised that she was deaf and dumb. The two thus meet and eventually get wise to the deception, but nevertheless marry and live happily. Score 1 for the lightning rod man. Few lightning rod man stories in real life ended so happily. More about that in a future column.
That's Tom Ezern.
Podcasters, ready, places, and action.
Hi, I'm Prairie Public Director of Radio, Bill Thomas, but I also direct our podcast.
Now, every father can break through to his son using the Father-Son Podcasting Microphone.
Yeah, we've got plenty of home-cooked podcasts for you to subscribe to. You want to bone up on Aristotle? Then subscribe to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, hosted by UND Philosophy Professor Jack Russell Weinstein.
What's wrong with that argument?
Get to know the quiet, poetic grace of people, past and present, who make up our party region through Tom Ezern's Plainsfolk essays.
Most of all, I'm thinking about that toothy fish.
And then there's the fascinating and diverse roster of guests on our daily statewide conversation convergence, Main Street. The belly laughs and fun culinary insights of Sue Balcom on Main Street Eats.
We're getting chickens, but don't tell them that, okay?
Breaking Barriers, a Red River Rainbow Seniors LGBTQ podcast. And then there's the always popular and shareable Dakota Date Book. You can subscribe to any one or all of these Prairie Public podcasts through Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, NPR One, or wherever you like to get them.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcasts anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.